There's an amazing world out there for you to discover, Henry Denton, but you have to be willing to discover yourself first. The bell rang, saving me, and we all rose like Pavlovian dogs, eager to run to our next classes. Except Diego. He was still sitting, like he was waiting for me to say something, but I didn't know what. Finally, I said, "What if I don't give a shit about the world?" Diego gathered our trash and frowned. "I'd say that's pretty fucking sad." "Why?" "Because the world is so beautiful." 4 October, 2015. Nana leaned on the shopping cart as we strolled through Publix, ignoring the other customers who shot us pissed-off glares every time she blocked the aisle to scan the shelves for some item from the crumpled list in her hand.
"What about pork chops?" she asked. "I could stuff them. Maybe fry some okra?"
"Sounds good." I grabbed a jar of spaghetti sauce and tossed it in the cart, which was filling up rapidly because Nana couldn't decide what she wanted for dinner. So far she'd suggested tacos, salmon with spinach, shepherd's pie, and lasagna, and we'd gathered the ingredients for each.
"Did you teach Mom how to cook?"
Nana kept shuffling down the aisle as if she hadn't heard me. I started to repeat the question when she said,
"Eleanor loved to watch me in the kitchen when she was a little girl, but I was never much of a cook. My grandmother passed her recipes to my mother, and she passed them to me, but your mother doesn't need recipes. She's quite gifted."
I grimaced. "So the Lewis women have been inflicting that meatloaf on their families for 4 generations? Nana smacked my arm.
"For your information, your mother loves my meatloaf."
"Get real. She spits it out in her napkin and flushes it down the toilet. Haven't you ever noticed how often she visits the can on meatloaf nights?" Nana hit me again harder.
"That's for lying to your grandmother."
I smiled and hugged her. She felt small and fragile, the way ice over a lake thins as the weather turns warm. Cracks were beginning to appear on the surface, but she'd always been a stubborn constant in my life, and I refused to count her out.
"It was your father," Nana said as we moved from one aisle to the next. "He encouraged your mother to become a chef when they were still in high school.
If she loves it so much, she should quit waiting tables and get a job cooking."
"Cooking reminds her of him."
Nana stopped the cart and seized a box of couscous, ignoring the frustrated grunt of a red-faced man as he squeezed past us.
"Sometimes, Henry, remembering hurts too much."
She patted my arm, her wrinkled fingers like dry carrots.
"And they shouldn't have gotten divorced. Life rarely works out the way we plan it."
"He left because of me, didn't he?" Nana stopped pushing the cart. She leaned on it heavily, like it was the only thing holding her up.
"Why would you think that?"
"It was my fault. I know it."
"You know that's not true, Henry."
Her words were sharp, and they stung more than her slap. She continued walking.
"Now enough of this. Tell me one good thing that happened to you today."
At first I thought she was joking, but she was lucid and totally serious.
"Nothing happened." "One thing, Henry."
"It was a boring day." Nana motioned for me to grab a gallon of milk as we passed the dairy case.
"When I was sick, so sick I thought I would die, sometimes the highlight of my day was that I hadn't soiled myself."
"Gross."
"When the days are darkest, dear, you latch on to happiness wherever you find it."
Mom hadn't let me or Charlie see Nana when she was going through chemotherapy, and we didn't talk about it after either. But the specter of death had haunted us for months. Even when her doctor said her cancer was in remission, I still felt the weight of death in Nana's house. I figured if she could find joy during those terrible times, I could give her one good thing.
"I had lunch with this guy. It was pretty okay." "Does this young man have a name?"
"Diego Vega." I liked the way it rolled off my tongue. "He's new. We've been eating together the past few days." Nana tossed creamed corn and green beans and artichoke hearts into our cart.
"I like new. New is mysterious. Tell me about him."
Lunch with Diego had become a thing, against my better judgment, but with each day that passed, I learned more about him. He lives with his sister, Viviana, who is a neat freak. His favorite cereal is Fruity Oat Holes. He loves superhero movies, even that train wreck Green Lantern.
He drives a 12-year-old Jetta named Please Start that frequently doesn't, and his greatest fear is being murdered by his time-traveling self from the future. We both had things we refused to discuss. I steered away from asking him why he moved, and he didn't bring up the sluggers. But Diego had become part of my life by default, and I didn't hate it. In fact, I began looking forward to lunch, to discussing our favorite bands and which teachers were probably doing it in the break room.
There's not much to tell.
Don't lie to your grandma. I knew she was trying, but there was nothing going on, and nothing likely to happen.
He's just a friend, Nana.
Why?
He had a girlfriend, which means he's probably not looking for a boyfriend.
Honestly, neither am I.
Well, a regular old friend is still a good thing to have. Since Jesse passed, I've been worried about you, and what happened to the young woman who used to come around? She always brushed my hair.
It's complicated. Everything's complicated. Only sometimes I wonder if it has to be. I could call Audrey any time, and we could pick up our friendship like nothing happened. But something did happen. Jesse is dead, and it's my fault, or her fault, or both our faults. There's no room in my life for Audrey in this after-Jesse world.
Still, Charlie.
Henry. Nana frowned.
Henry's dead.
No, I'm Henry, your grandson.
That's not funny, Charlie.
Nana shook her head and kept on like I hadn't interrupted her.
It's nice that you've made a new friend. You should invite him over for dinner.
It seemed pointless to even consider it. Pointless to put in the effort to get to know him when the world was going to end. Except, I could imagine him sitting between Mom and Nana, kicking me under the table as my brother unleashed his most embarrassing stories about me. I could picture Diego sitting where Jesse once had, and that stirred up emotions, both pleasant and painful, I wasn't equipped to deal with in the cereal aisle of the grocery store.
Maybe, I said. Just so long as you promise not to cook meatloaf.
16 October, 2015. Charlie banged on the bathroom door while I brushed my teeth. Every time the mirror fogged over, I had to clear it with the palm of my hand, which didn't really help. I hadn't seen much of my brother since the big baby announcement, which meant my life had been quieter and more bruise-free than usual. He'd spent most of the last month with Zoe or couch-surfing at various friends' houses, but now that he was back home, he seemed hell-bent on making up for lost time.
"Open the door! I'm going to be late for work!"
I spit a mouthful of toothpaste into the sink.
"I'll be out in a second."
I'd been brushing my teeth for the last 5 minutes, and didn't have anything else I needed to do in the bathroom. But I still took my time, rinsing my mouth and shaving, and making sure no stray boogers were hanging out of my nose. The banging finally stopped, but that's how I knew something was up. Charlie was nothing if not relentless. He once went 4 days without food when he was little because Mom had refused to buy him a stuffed giraffe he wanted. Still damp from the steam and wearing only a towel, I hurried to my bedroom. The door was open, and I was greeted by the sight of Charlie standing beside my desk, pissing into my trash can. When he saw me, he didn't stop. Not Charlie. Instead, he flashed me a toothy, sadistic grin, the kind that makes me wonder if my brother is a sociopath. I didn't know what to do other than stand there in total disbelief while he finished, shook off the last drops, and zipped up his fly.
"Oh," Charlie said, "was that your homework? If Mom finds out you didn't turn it in, you're in a lot of trouble."
I didn't think it possible for me to hate my brother more than I did, but I should have known better.
"Get it? You're in a lot of trouble?"
I glanced at the black plastic trash can, and then at my brother. Trash can. Brother. Trash can. Brother.
What kind of fucking psycho pisses on someone's homework?
You don't need to be a little bitch about it. Anyway, I told you to get out of the bathroom.
Charlie, you pissed on my homework. In my bedroom.
Drops of urine had splattered out of the wastebasket and clung to the side of my desk.
I can't believe Zoe didn't have an abortion the moment she realized she was pregnant with your demon spawn.
Before I could stop him, before I even knew what was happening, Charlie charged across the room and clamped his hand around my throat. He slammed me into the door, grinding my shoulder blades against the wood.
"Don't you ever fucking talk about my kid like that."
He didn't even yell. That was the scariest part. His voice was this calm, steady thrum, but he didn't need to yell for me to hear how deadly serious he was. I slapped Charlie's wrists, not that I was strong enough to break free. I may have been afraid, but I refused to back down. Die right then at Charlie's hands, or die in 105 days from an unknown disaster, it made no difference to me.
"Please. You're such a fuck-up, you'll probably scar that little parasite for life, and then abandon it like Dad abandoned us."
My voice croaked from my throat as air fought to escape. Charlie released me. His chest heaved and sweat rolled down his temples. He loomed over me, despite being shorter. For a moment I thought our fight was done, that Charlie was finished with me. But I was mistaken. I didn't even have time to block before he sucker-punched me in the gut. I cried out and clutched my stomach.
"Dad didn't abandon us," he said.
"He abandoned you." I struggled to breathe, to look Charlie in the eyes and call him a liar, tell him he was the worst fucking brother in the universe, that I would have been better off an only child. But I didn't say any of those things. I didn't say anything at all.
"He was so ashamed of what a pathetic loser you were that he couldn't stand being around you. Everyone you care about either runs away or kills themselves. And you think I'm a fuck-up."
I shoved Charlie out of my room and slammed the door. I leaned against it, slid to the floor, and put my head in my hands. I wasn't crying because of what Charlie said. I was crying because, deep down, I knew he was right. All day at school, I couldn't stop thinking about my fight with Charlie, about what he'd said. When my parents divorced, they didn't sit me and Charlie down to explain what was happening. One day, Dad was just gone, and we stopped talking about him like he'd never existed in the first place. All traces that he'd ever lived at our house disappeared. In my heart, I'd always known he'd taken off because of me. It wasn't a coincidence that he left only a few weeks after my first abduction. I was so caught up in my own thoughts that I hardly knew what was going on around me at school. I ignored Audrey when she asked me if I wanted help studying for our next chemistry exam. I blew past Ms. Ferraci before she could keep me after class again, and I planned on ditching Diego at lunch, too. I was on my way to my locker when Marcus pulled me into an empty art room. Sketches done in charcoal and pencil plastered the walls, and I wondered which ones, if any, belonged to Diego.
"What the hell, Marcus?"
He'd nearly yanked my arm out of the socket, and I'd already been abused enough for one day. Marcus was fidgety. His eyes were wide and manic. His shirt was untucked, and a cluster of pimples that reminded me of the constellation Andromeda dotted his forehead. But he still smelled like summer.
"How's it going, Space Boy?"
"Don't call me Space Boy." A growl crouched in my throat.
"I haven't seen you in a while."
The classroom was empty, but Mr. Creedy often let students work on projects during lunch, so I expected we wouldn't be alone for long. "Aren't you afraid of being seen talking to Space Boy? Or are you going to throw more nickels at me?" Marcus shook his head. His bangs fell over his forehead, and he flicked them back.
"No. I missed you, Henry."
I tapped my lips with the tip of my finger. "Wouldn't it be great if we had a magical device that allowed two people to talk over long distances anytime they wanted? They could call it a talkie box." Marcus closed the gap between us and placed his hand flat against my chest. I felt the familiar tingle, and I hated that I missed it.
"I know you don't believe me, but I like you. I don't want us to be over."
We were so close, I could feel the heat radiating off his skin. I wanted to tell him that I missed him, too. It would have been easy to give in and go to some storage closet, to kiss him and forget about all the yesterdays and tomorrows. But I couldn't forget wanting to die by his pool the night of the party, or walking home because he thought I was a joke. "I can't be one thing to you behind the bleachers and another in front of your friends." Marcus sneered.
"I get it. You got a new boyfriend and you don't need me anymore."
"Boyfriend? What are you talking about? I've seen you together at lunch."
"Diego?"
Marcus flinched when I said the name. "He's a friend, nothing more."
"Is that just someone you banged to get over your dead boyfriend?"
Marcus had never spoken to me like that before. I honestly didn't think he cared enough about me to be jealous.
"No, Jesus, Marcus.
Then come to my house tonight. My parents are attending a fundraiser and won't be home until late."
Gone was the swagger he used like a glamour to hide this needy boy who was begging me to come home with him. If I say yes, how long before the next time you humiliate me to amuse your friends?
It won't be like that.
I want to believe you.
Space boy, you were my first.
His voice trembled. I hadn't known, which made it worse. I wanted to stay angry, but this Marcus would have invited me to his party. He would have introduced me to his friends. This was the most real he'd ever been, but it wouldn't last. The moment we walked out of the classroom, his cocksure veneer, the spit and polish, would return. I wasn't going to spend my last days on Earth as the butt of his jokes. I may not be sure I want to live, but I'm sure I don't want to live like that. Marcus, I can't. His armor snapped into place. The vulnerable boy I might have said yes to disappeared, and I'm not sure I'll ever see him again.
I'm not surprised Jesse hanged himself. I'm just surprised he didn't do it sooner.
Marcus shoved me against the wall as he stormed out. I spent my lunch sitting outside the library, trying to comprehend how my life had gotten so fucked up. First my father left, then Jesse. Neither Charlie nor Marcus told me anything I hadn't already considered. It has been 268 days since I got the phone call from Mrs. Franklin telling me Jesse committed suicide. He left no note, gave no explanation, but I still know it was my fault. He killed himself because of me. Because I loved him too much, or not enough. I don't know why. All I know is that it was my fault. Charlie's and Marcus's words festered in me, and by the time I got to P.E., I wanted to hurt someone, anyone, to make them feel how I felt. Narrow rows of lockers separated by benches, fellow students changing into their gym clothes, and the pungent odor of sweat and body spray made my skin itch. I wanted to get dressed for class and get out as quickly as possible. I shouldered past a couple of kids and opened my gym locker. Nickels poured out. There had to be hundreds of dollars worth of them spilling to the floor, and I just stared as they fell. Adrian Morse stood a few feet away by the water fountain, with Gary Newman, Chris Weller, and Dean Gold, laughing his ass off. It must have taken them at least an hour to get all those nickels into my locker. All for a moment's cheap laugh. The sound in my ears narrowed until all I could hear was that psychotic cackle. I felt something inside me break in that moment. It wasn't just what had happened that day. It was as if all the preceding days, all the hate I'd been hoarding and the guilt I'd buried, erupted, breaking my ability to contain them any longer. I ran toward Adrian and launched myself at him, not caring if he beat the crap out of me. I swung wildly, a berserker bloodlust overriding my rational mind. I screamed at him, but can't remember what I said. Adrian tried to protect his face, but my fist connected with something solid, and that only made me fight harder. It seemed like hours, but was probably only seconds before he kneed me in the crotch, knocking the breath out of me. I fell to the ground and he kicked me, but I roared back and tackled him, slamming his back against the lockers, pounding him with my fists. I was beyond pain, beyond all reason. I didn't care about anything. Not me, not Jesse, not Marcus. The world was ending, and there were no more consequences. I think I was going to kill him. Coach Raskin wedged himself between us, yelling at us to break it up, and wrestled me away from Adrian. I struggled to free myself from his powerful grip, but Coach was too strong for me. I shook myself loose and glared at Adrian, sprawled on the locker room floor. Blood ran from his nose and I smiled. I spit at his feet and left. Mom didn't talk to me until we were in the car. She'd come straight from work, still in her uniform, her apron stained with ketchup and potato soup. After I buckled my seatbelt, I examined my bloody, bruised knuckles. My hand hurt when I flexed it, but it was a good hurt, an anchor. Because Adrian had started it with the nickels, Principal DeShields opted for a month of Saturday detentions rather than suspension. I would have preferred the suspension.
"Do you want to tell me what's gotten into you, Henry Jerome Denton?"
That asshole had it coming. Mom slapped me across the face. My cheek stung and I touched my jaw while she glowered at me.
"You sound like your father."
She cranked up the radio and peeled out of the parking lot, headed for home. My mom had never hit me before, but I think I deserved it. "It's true, you know."
"What is?"
I turned down the music. That Adrian deserved it.
That doesn't excuse fighting.
I know. Mom sighed, shook her head.
It's been rough for you, Henry. I know. But you can't do this. You're flunking 3 classes, getting into fights. I hardly see you because you're always locked in your room.
I wanted to tell her she'd know what was going on with me if she ever bothered to ask. But she was so concerned with Charlie and Nana, or too tired from working to bother with me. Aliens abduct me, and she pretends I'm sleepwalking. My boyfriend killed himself, and we don't even talk about it. Like my father, Jesse's name just disappeared from her vocabulary. I would have told her anything, everything, if she had asked, but I knew she wouldn't. If the world were going to end, but you could stop it, would you? Mom drove for a while without answering. I thought she hadn't heard me, and I leaned my head against the window. Finally, she said,
"Some days I think I would. Other days, probably not."
"What about today?" Mom's shoulders bowed downward.
"What do you think, Henry?"
Nanobots. They're hailed as a marvelous breakthrough in modern medicine. Their inventors, 2 scientists from South Africa, are awarded the Nobel Prize for Medicine for their work. The tiny robots are too small to see with the naked eye, but are capable of cooperating to eradicate any disease and to repair any damage done to the human body. The fixers, as they're called, usher in what many refer to as the golden age of humanity. Despite warnings from paranoid extremist groups, governments around the world approve fixers for widespread use. Billionaire philanthropists donate their entire fortunes to fund efforts that bring fixers to impoverished nations, making certain that every human on the planet in need is able to receive treatment. Within 1 year, cancer becomes little more than a nuisance, curable with 1 treatment and no side effects. Within 2 years, HIV, cerebral palsy, Huntington's disease, blindness, polio, and male pattern baldness are eradicated. They become footnotes in history. Genetic defects are repaired in utero. 2 years, 9 months, 7 days, and 2 hours after fixers are approved for public use, the world experiences its first full day without a single death. It is the day humanity becomes God. It begins on 26 January 2016 at 7:35 a.m. EST at a Starbucks in Augusta, Georgia. Donald Catt, already irritated over having to wait in line, completely loses his cool when the barista doesn't know how to make his drink the way he likes it. Despite the barista's attempts to calm him, Donald refuses to leave until he gets what he wants, prepared exactly the way he wants it. The store manager eventually calls the police. Donald Catt resists, and the officers have no choice but to taser him. The electrical shock causes a fixer, deployed to repair Donald's erectile dysfunction, to malfunction. It scrambles the fixer's software and initiates self-replication. Fixers were designed to replicate under strictly regulated conditions, but the damaged fixer replicates uncontrollably at an exponential rate, using whatever materials are at hand. That includes still twitching, under-caffeinated Donald Catt. Attempts to quarantine Georgia are unsuccessful, and the new fixers, whose sole function is to replicate, consume the entire planet in 3 days, leaving behind nothing but an ocean of gray goo. 20 October, 2015. My situation at school deteriorated. Marcus and Adrian glued my locker shut and wrote Spaceboy Gargles Alien Balls on the door in permanent marker. I couldn't walk the halls without being stalked by whispers and cruel laughter. I tried to ignore them, but that only made them meaner. In P.E., Adrian's been keeping his distance, but I've noticed the murderous glares he shoots me across the gym. I started something I'm certain he's determined to finish. Diego is still a mystery, but I enjoy spending time with him. He listens when I need to vent, talks when I don't want to, and knows more about literature than anyone I've ever met. The only thing about him that unnerves me is the dark look that falls over him when I tell him about something that Marcus said, or that J.O. and Adrian have done. It's like a completely different person replaces the smiling Diego I've come to know. And then, quicker than a summer storm, it disappears, leaving me to wonder if I imagined his reaction. Nothing will make me change my mind about the button, but I'm trying my best to maintain the status quo for the days that remain. I figure if I keep my head down, maybe I can serve out the balance of my life sentence in relative peace. Wake up, go to school, go home. Repeat until the world ends. The house was quiet when I got home from school. Mom wasn't screaming at anyone, and Charlie wasn't being Charlie. It was nice. Living in a house with my mother, brother, and Nana means that someone is usually shouting or dashing from one room to the next as if everything is of monumental importance. I wish they understood how little their actions matter. With the end of the world looming, I can finally see the pointlessness of everything. How the whole of human civilization is nothing more than a mosquito's annoying buzz to the universe. My stomach rumbled, so I figured I'd make a snack and watch TV while there was no one around to bother me. The fridge was pretty barren, so I settled for peanut butter and jelly. The bread had some mold on it, but I cut it off, too hungry to care. A sonogram with Hawthorne, Zoe, printed across the bottom, clung to the refrigerator door, held in place by a magnet from our favorite Chinese takeout joint. The picture looked like a miniature monochrome galaxy, teeming with stars and worlds and boundless potential. I took the sonogram to the kitchen table and tried to determine which part of the amorphous blob was my future niece or nephew. It was a game, find the fetus. Was it too early to know the sex? Probably. Not that it mattered. It wasn't even a baby yet. It was just a little parasite, and it would never be anything else. A shadow fell across the table, startling me. Nana hovered to my left, staring at the picture over my shoulder. "Jesus, Nana, you scared the crap out of me." Nana's flaccid, wrinkled cheeks pulled back into an impish grin.
"Mission accomplished."
She eased into the seat next to mine and snatched the sonogram, turning it this way and that, examining it from every angle.
"What the devil am I looking at?"
"Charlie and Zoe's kid, I think."
"Are you certain? It looks like an inkblot test."
Nana covered her right eye.
"I see Jonah and the whale."
"I won't tell Zoe you called her a whale." Nana snorted.
"I wonder if they've thought about names."
"Probably not. I call it the little parasite."
"I like that," Nana said. "That little parasite is lucky. Its life is just beginning, while mine is nearly over."
"Don't say that."
"You'll understand when you're my age, Henry. You spend your life hoarding memories against the day when you'll lack the energy to go out and make new ones, because that's the comfort of old age. The ability to look back on your life and know that you left your mark on the world. But I'm losing my memories. It's like someone's broken into my piggy bank and is robbing me one penny at a time. It's happening so slowly, I can hardly tell what's missing."
I tried to think of the right thing to say, but sometimes the right thing to say is nothing.
"I look at people, and I don't know them. Yesterday I spent 20 minutes trying to figure out who the grumpy woman sitting beside me was before I realized it was your mother."
I laughed, and Nana offered me a feeble smile in return.
"I've led a rich life, Henry, but I'm terrified of dying a pauper."
While there are some memories I wish I could dispose of, sometimes my memories are the only things that keep me sane. There are times when I walk along the beach and smell the hot tar and sand, and I think of all the summer days Jesse and I spent lying in the sun, making our plans to rule the world. Then there are times when I see something funny on TV or hear a great song, and I pick up my phone to text Jesse before I remember he's dead. And the wound tears open, bloody and raw all over again. A person can become a part of you as real as your arm or leg, and even though Jesse is dead, I still feel the weight of that phantom limb. I have 1,000 amazing memories of Jesse, but his suicide is leaking into those recollections, poisoning our past. I can hardly remember him without hating him for taking his life and leaving me alone in mine. I honestly don't know whether it would be better to forget or be able to remember, but it physically hurts being forced to watch Nana diminish. Charlie and Zoe's baby will never know the terror of creating memories only to lose them, but Nana knows all too well. I love you, Nana. I was sitting in the living room, flipping through the channels, unable to find anything worth watching, when Charlie and Zoe came home. I didn't want to be in the same room with Charlie, but I wasn't about to leave and let him think he'd beaten me. He mumbled about needing to take a shower before stomping toward the bathroom. Zoe looked cute in a pair of little jean shorts and blousy white top. I've never been able to figure out what magic my brother cast to make someone like her stay with him. To want to have a kid with him. When they first began dating, I assumed she must have been blind. But she wasn't. She actually and improbably seemed to like Charlie. Love him, even. "What you watching?" Zoe asked. She flopped down onto the couch with a thick book and a legal pad. I'd stopped on the bunker live feeds, but no one was doing anything interesting. You could watch for hours and never see any good action. It was a miracle the producers were able to cobble together enough entertaining footage for 3 weekly shows. "Nothing." I tossed the remote to Zoe and started to stand, but she said, "Don't leave on my account. I have so much studying to do." "What class?" She rolled her eyes and glanced at her book. "Just a stupid history survey."
"Sounds like a blast."
"I hate it. Not history. History's pretty cool. Just the way they cram 2,000 years of human civilization into a 5-month class." Zoe shook her head. "Seriously, it's like history for dummies. No, strike that. It's like white male history for dummies. The professor totally ignores every major contribution by anyone who wasn't a white dude."
She talked about history the way I felt about science.
"Science is all around us. We are science. It governs our bodies, how we interact with the world and universe. But most people are too stupid to realize it. They think science is optional. Like if they refuse to believe in gravity, they can simply ignore it."
"Is that what you want to do?" I asked. "Be a historian, I mean?"
"No," she said. "I think I want to be a psychologist."
Zoe flashed me a wry smile. "To be honest, I'm not even 100% certain about that."
"You've definitely got the patience for it. You'd have to, dating my brother and all."
"Who knows? Maybe I'll major in history, too, and become a historical psychologist."
"Is that even a thing?"
Zoe shrugged.
"Got me." Talking to her was easy. Even when she was watching the TV with one eye, I felt like she was really listening to me, like she actually cared.
"If you knew the world was ending, and you had the chance to stop it, would you?"
"Of course."
Zoe rubbed her belly. She wasn't even showing yet, not that I could see.
"Why do you ask?"
"Oh," I said, "it's for a school project."
"That's interesting."
I shook my head. "Not really. Like I said, it's just a school thing." Zoe turned toward me, giving me her undivided attention.
"Not the question. The fact that you'd even need to ask."
"You don't think there are some pretty compelling reasons for wiping the earth clean and starting over?"
"No,"
she said, "but clearly you do." I didn't get the opportunity to respond because Charlie returned, his shirt sticking to his still damp body. He flopped down between me and Zoe and grabbed the remote, which was my cue to leave. Though she didn't say anything, I felt Zoe's eyes on my back as I left the room. I was surprised when Diego texted me later that evening to meet him outside in 20 minutes. He refused to tell me where we were going, but Charlie and Zoe had ordered pizza and traded her history homework for baby name books, so I was especially grateful for the opportunity to escape. Diego grinned when I hopped into the car and didn't even wait for me to buckle my seatbelt before throwing "please start" into drive and lurching toward our destination, which didn't take long to deduce. "We could have walked here," I said, when Diego parked on the side of the beach road. It was empty save for a couple of packs of cyclists that whizzed past, wearing those obscenely tight spandex shorts.
"I didn't want to carry that."
He pointed at a long black duffel bag in the back seat. "Are those the tools you're going to use to kill and dismember me?" Diego rolled his eyes.
"If they were, do you think I'd tell you?"
"I'd tell you."
"As if. I'm pretty sure the only thing you could dismember is a sandwich."
Diego hoisted the bag over his shoulder.
"Speaking of, there's a sack with subs on the floor. Grab the pop, too."
He started down the dunes, and I had to hustle to catch up. By the time he stopped, my shoes were full of sand, so I kicked them aside and peeled off my socks.
"If I'd known we were going to the beach, I would have worn flip-flops." "You usually do. I hadn't expected you to be in fancy dress."
"Fancy?" I tried to ignore my burning ears, but I'd be lying if I said I hadn't put some thought into my outfit. Still, it was only jeans and a V-neck tee. Compared to Diego, though, I suppose I was a little dressy. He was wearing khaki shorts and a green tank that showed off his lack of tan lines and his impressive shoulders. I tried not to stare at the way his muscles rippled when he moved, but I rationalized that it would be insulting not to admire them a little. Anyway, at least I can pick a style and stick with it.
What's that supposed to mean?
Preppy one day, surfer the next? It's like you can't decide who to be. Diego shrugged.
I like to try new things. You don't go to a buffet and only eat spaghetti all night.
Still, it's weird. I walked to the edge of the water and breathed in the salt air. The sun had set, but the western sky was the color of peach skin, while the sky over the ocean was a clear lapis blue. The moon was a bright smile, hovering high to the south.
Is this the surprise?
Diego knelt beside the bag and lifted out a navy tube and black tripod. It slipped, and I rushed to help.
It's my sister's telescope. I thought you'd enjoy looking at the stars.
I guess. I'd never looked through a telescope before, and I'd always wanted to. But I kept waiting for Diego to crack an alien joke or ask me about the abductions, even though he hadn't mentioned either in weeks. After 20 minutes of trying to set up the telescope, Diego threw his hands in the air and admitted defeat. I had no idea what I was doing, but I tried to aim it at something interesting anyway. You know, I said as I fiddled with the knobs, kind of like that you suck at something.
Me? You're crazy. I suck at lots of things. Stargazing, for instance. And ping pong. I'm the world's worst ping pong player.
Diego busied himself with spreading out a ratty blanket that had been wadded up in the bag with a telescope.
Anything?
I peered through the eyepiece and tweaked it until I managed to bring Neptune more or less into focus. Check it out. Diego sprang to his feet and peeked through the lens.
Is it supposed to be that small?
It's almost 3 billion miles away. Even traveling at the speed of light, it would still take about 4 hours to reach. I tried to imagine standing on that cold, distant planet, breathing hydrogen and helium, viewing Earth from the other side of the solar system. I wondered if it was lonely out there on the edge of space, so far from the light and warmth of the sun. I bet I can find Saturn. We can probably see its rings.
It's not a very good telescope, is it?
Better than nothing. Diego patted the tube.
Viv got it cheap, I think. She's not a telescope expert.
And you are?
No.
Diego swiveled the telescope to another part of the sky and looked through the eyepiece. He kept adjusting the knobs, but I don't think he knew what he was doing.
I just thought I could show you something beautiful.
He glared at the telescope.
Or try to, anyway.
I trudged back to the blanket, flopping down and staring at my toes. It was one of the most considerate things anyone had done for me, and that twisted my stomach into knots. Why are you so nice to me?
I got a soft spot for lost causes.
I'm not your charity case. Diego abandoned the telescope and sat across from me. The way he looked at me, with curiosity or pity, I couldn't tell which, made me wish I'd ignored his text.
It was a joke, Henry.
That's what Marcus always says.
That's because he's a douche.
He's not. I mean, yeah, he is, but sometimes he's okay.
Wait, Diego's eyes widened. Please tell me Marcus isn't the guy you've been fooling around with.
No, I said, but it was obvious I was lying when my voice broke. Damn it. I stood and walked to the water, let the waves run over my toes. If I dove in, maybe I could swim off the edge of the world. When I heard Diego behind me, I said, don't you dare tell anyone.
I won't.
I'm serious.
I know how to keep a secret.
That's obvious. I waited for Diego to decide I was too much trouble, to leave or fight with me, something. He simply stood beside me while the moments passed and my anger drained into the ocean. Then he said,
you actually like him?
I thought I did.
He's not the kind of guy I figured you'd go for.
He isn't.
Then why?
Because he's not Jesse. It was the first time I'd admitted it to myself. Marcus and Jesse were so different. Jesse had never called me Space Boy. He never would have hit me, hadn't cared what his friends thought, and I'd never felt ashamed of who I was with him.
Jesse had loved me. But that's a lie, isn't it? If Jesse had loved me, he wouldn't have left me. Marcus isn't a bad guy. He can be sweet. A wave splashed across my feet and sloshed up my legs, soaking the cuffs of my jeans. In the dark, it was difficult to see where the ocean ended and the sky began. I could pretend the sky curved down and around, and that it was possible to walk on the clouds. But even though I wasn't looking at Diego, I felt the pull of him, the way he distorted everything around him, so I didn't know what was right or real anymore.
What about all the names he calls you? The shit he and his friends put you through? The guy who does that, well, he's not really boyfriend material. I mean, is that honestly who you want to be with? Diego's voice contained a dangerous undertow. He hardly sounded like the boy who'd flung himself into my chemistry class, pretending to be a nude model. Well, is it? I knew the answer. Jesse Franklin was who I wanted to be with. Jesse, who'd wrapped his arms around my waist and kissed my neck and told me it was going to be okay after I fought with my mom, and who stayed up all night on the phone with me when he went to Rhode Island to visit his family for Christmas. And we watched the sunrise together, even though we were separated by 1,377 miles. That was who I wanted to be with. But he was dead. Maybe that's what I deserve, I said under my breath.
What?
It doesn't matter. Of course it does. We're all gonna die. Which is why it matters. Diego stood beside me quietly for a few seconds before he returned to the blanket. Hungry? He tossed me a sub, roast beef with all the veggies. I didn't have the heart to tell him I hated onions.
Thanks.
I unwrapped it and ate it even though I wasn't hungry. Diego didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't know Marcus, he didn't know Jesse, and he didn't know me. If he did, he'd understand. I met Jesse freshman year. I knew who he was. Everyone knew Jesse Franklin. It wasn't that he was popular, but he had this way of dominating a room. No matter how many other people were there, you couldn't help noticing Jesse. Of course, he talked to me first. I never would have had the courage to approach him. It was during lunch. I always sat alone, reading, and he walked up to my table, all smiles and perfect hair, and asked me if my name was Daniel. I told him it wasn't, but he insisted I looked like this guy Daniel he'd known from summer camp. Finally, he asked me my name. But it wasn't just Jesse standing there. It felt like every kid in the cafeteria was at my table asking. I've never done well under pressure, so when I opened my mouth to answer, I said, "I don't know," instead. Diego snorted and laughed. Jesse gave me this crazy look and was like, "You don't know your own name?" And all I could do was nod, even though in my brain I was screaming, "Henry Denton! My name is Henry!" Jesse eventually returned to his own table. I was sure I'd blown my only chance to get to know him.
But you hadn't, Diego said.
No.
I felt a tear burning in the corner of my eye, but I refused to acknowledge it. I wasn't going to cry in front of Diego. I ran into him at the mall a few weeks later. Actually, he'd found out my name from one of his friends, and when he saw me with my mom shopping for shoes, he chased after me, yelling my name. My mom thought he was a lunatic, but all he wanted to do was give me his number. Diego finished his sub and tossed the crumpled wax paper into his duffel bag.
Your Jesse sounds like a cool guy.
My Jesse. He wasn't anyone's Jesse anymore. He was the best. We spent almost every second together, and when we were apart, it hurt. It physically hurt. My entire life revolved around Jesse. But in the end, it didn't matter. He slipped a noose around his neck and hanged himself without saying goodbye. No note, no text, no last voicemail. The last thing he said to me was that I needed a haircut, like it was just another day. Only it wasn't any other day. It was the day before he committed suicide. If everything matters, wouldn't Jesse have said something more meaningful? Wouldn't he have wanted to do more than hang out and watch TV like we always did? Wouldn't he have at least left me a note to explain why he felt he had to die, instead of leaving me here alone, wondering why? Why is Jesse dead? Why am I not? I waited for Diego to answer. I wasn't sure how he had expected the night to go, but I doubted it was this.
There was nothing he could say that would change my mind, but I waited for him to try. Instead, he said,
"You think we could see them with the telescope?"
"Them?"
"The aliens."
"I don't want to talk about it."
"Okay, sure."
A moment later, he said,
"I believe you, you know."
"I don't need you to believe me."
"I know. It's one of the things I like most about you."
It caught me off guard, and I didn't know how to reply. Diego stood up, brushing the sand off his shorts. He peered through the telescope again. Maybe he was looking for the sluggers, maybe he just wanted to see the stars and dream of a world beyond this one, while I sat on the blanket and remembered Jesse. Dreams are hopeful because they exist as pure possibility. Unlike memories, which are fossils, long dead and buried deep. We stayed at the beach for a while longer, but no matter how much we fiddled with the telescope, the stars never seemed so far away.
30 October, 2015. Sometimes I wonder if the sluggers sent Diego Vega to Calypso to test my resolve. It makes more sense than his persistent attempts to be my friend when everyone else at school barely notices me. His reluctance to talk about his past, coupled with the fact that I haven't been abducted since Marcus's party, makes me seriously consider that this is simply an elaborate experiment, and Diego is nothing more than a variable in a slugger equation. For all I know, it might not even matter whether I press the button. Not that I've changed my mind about that. The Friday before Halloween, Principal DeShields allowed students to wear costumes to school, though the list of prohibited items was extensive and included masks, weapons, real or fake, excessive cleavage, wearing underwear on the outside of clothes, fake blood or bodily fluids of any kind, glitter, vampire teeth, which may or may not have fallen into the weapons category, clown costumes of any kind. I didn't wear a costume, but Marcus showed up as Captain America, and I overheard Audrey claim to be Joan of Arc, which was fitting. Miss Ferraci was supposed to be an oxygen molecule, but her outfit, pieced together with coat hangers, duct tape, and cardboard, carried the unfortunate whiff of homemade desperation. It's both cool and mortifying to have a teacher so passionate. Marcus, Jay, and Adrian spent the entire period whispering to one another, cutting up like they didn't think anyone could hear them. I did my best to ignore the name-calling and laughter, and between the impending end of the world and Diego, I hadn't spent much time worrying about what fiendish plans Marcus and his boys were cooking up. Before the bell rang, I noticed Diego waiting outside the door. He grinned at me and waved. We were only friends, but I hoped Marcus saw him. It was tough to tell whether Diego had dressed up like a surfer for Halloween, wearing board shorts and a tank top, or if he was just trying on another style. Anyway, it never seemed to matter what Diego wore. He always looked like he belonged. I envied that about him, since I never belonged anywhere. The classroom became bedlam when Ms. Ferraci dismissed us for lunch. I'd started hanging back, waiting for Marcus and the others to leave first. Adrian especially enjoyed shoving me into the edge of my desk, leaving me with bruises across my thighs, so I'd learned it was best to remain seated until they were gone. Diego stood at the threshold of the door, leaning from one foot to the other.
"Ah, my nude model has returned."
Ms. Ferraci waddled around her desk and lifted the oxygen molecule over her head, setting it on the floor. She looked strange and lumpy in her faded unitard. Diego blushed.
"Yeah, sorry about that. First day jitters."
I shouldered my bag and hurried for the door.
"Have a good weekend, Ms. Ferraci." "Henry, wait."
I flinched, knowing what she wanted.
"About your extra credit."
My chemistry grade was the last thing I wanted to discuss in front of Diego, and I had a perfectly horrible BLT waiting in my locker. Of course, the B was actually butter, and the T was probably tuna. I really needed to stop letting Nana pack my lunches.
"Can we talk about it later?"
"Your last quiz was an improvement, but you still need to do the extra credit project to pull your grade up. You need at least a B to get into physics next year."
"I'll think about it."
I inched closer to the door with every word.
"It can be anything, Henry. Essay, experiment, song and dance. Just give me something I can slap a grade on."
She was practically begging.
The last time a teacher cared so much about my academic welfare was in first grade. All the standardized tests said I was a below-average reader, but Mrs. Stansel kept me after school every day to tutor me. I don't remember when the blocks of words began to make sense, but by the end of that school year I'd gone from book-hater to bookworm. But this was different, and I wanted to tell Ms. Ferraci not to waste her time. None of this would matter in 91 days.
"You should write a story, Henry," Diego said, stepping into the classroom. "Henry likes to write, you know."
Miss Ferraci's eyes widened with delight. "I did not know that."
I prayed for the sluggers to take me away, but they didn't answer. They were probably using their alien technology to spy on me, laughing their eye stalks off.
"Don't listen to Diego. He lies, pathologically. He can't help himself." "Did I ever tell you that I was almost an English teacher? I spent a year studying medieval literature."
Miss Ferraci's molecules were jittery with excitement.
"I would love it if you wrote a story."
With Diego and Ferraci both gaping at me, hope and optimism relentlessly beaming from them, my resolve began to fizzle.
"What would I write about?"
"Write what you know," Diego said.
"But I don't know anything."
Miss Ferraci shook her head.
"Oh, Henry, don't you understand? You know everything."
It was a stupid idea to schedule P.E. immediately after lunch. Coach Raskin informed us after we'd dressed that we were going to be running 4 miles, mandatory participation, with him jogging behind us, screaming inspiration in the form of personal insults, as if that were actually going to work.
Yes, I did want to go home and cry to my mommy. No, I did not care that a one-legged octogenarian could outrun me.
I managed to jog the 1st mile, but the air was thicker than tree sap, and the pizza I'd eaten for lunch instead of the BLT squirmed in my stomach like a bottled-up squid. I tried to keep up my pace for the 2nd mile, but I developed a stitch in my side, right under my ribs, and I was panting so hard I thought I would faint. When everyone else had finished and gone to the locker room to change, I still had 2 laps to go, and Coach Raskin made sure I completed them. The 1st bell had already rung, so the showers were empty, which I was grateful for. Showers after gym had been mandatory in middle school, and I'd spent years perfecting how to be naked for the least amount of time. The other boys seemed comfortable in their own skin. I felt like an alien. If I hadn't been soaked with sweat and smelled like the inside of one of Charlie's sneakers, I would have doubled up on deodorant and skipped the shower. But since I was already going to be late for last period, I decided it didn't matter. Besides, I didn't want to reek when Diego took me home. Even though he'd clearly mentioned his ex-girlfriend, possibly to make sure I knew he wasn't into me, I am more confused by him than ever. But I know what it means that I get excited when I see him, and bummed when I don't. I'm starting to like him, and that's a losing scenario for everyone. Even if the world wasn't coming to an end, Diego and I are an impossibility. Beyond all reason, he wants to be my friend, but would never be interested in more. Even if things were different, if the world weren't ending, and Diego were into me, I can't take the chance that it was my fault Jesse hanged himself, and that I might cause Diego to do the same. It might seem ludicrous to believe I caused Jesse's suicide, but in the dearth of answers he left behind, it makes as much sense as anything else. The warning bell rang, and I rushed to rinse the last of the shampoo from my hair and shut off the water. I retrieved my towel from the hook on the wall and tried to dry off in the humid air. The best I could hope to do was mitigate the disaster. I was drying my hair, the towel draped over my head, and didn't hear their footsteps. They were on me before I knew what was happening, one on each arm, dressed in black, wearing alien masks. They weren't my aliens. The oval eyes gave them away. There were no shadows either, and sluggers wouldn't have grabbed me and slapped a sweaty hand over my mouth to prevent me from screaming. The 3 aliens wrestled me to the floor. They were stronger, but I kicked and bucked and tried to run. Dignity be damned. My knee slammed into the tile floor, and my leg went numb. An alien stuffed a pair of boxers into my mouth, while another bound my wrists together with tape. My shoulders ached from struggling, like they were going to pop out of their sockets. When they finished with my hands, they pulled my legs out from under me and secured my ankles, leaving me prone on the wet, mildewed floor. I sobbed and tried to breathe, but I snorted water up my nose instead.
This is how I die. In the midst of the chaos in my mind, that's the thought that calmed me. This didn't matter. Nothing they did to me was important. I'd been ready to let the world end, prepared to sit back and wait for the apocalypse. What did it matter if I died a few weeks early? What did I matter at all?
Hurry up. Where's Coach? Taking a dump. Bring it, bring it.
The tile was slippery and I swung my legs around, trying to squirm away. The tallest alien kicked me in the testicles with his grass-stained sneaker. The pain was excruciating, and it clawed through my stomach and up my spine. I gagged, trying not to puke with the underwear in my mouth. My vision blurred around the edges, and I thought for a moment the sluggers had come to save me. But no one was coming to save me.
Everything hurt. It hurt to move and breathe. I wished they'd kill me and be done with it. I looked up. One of them stood over me with a 5-gallon bucket. I swore I saw him grinning through his garish alien mask.
Now you can be an alien too, space boy.
He tilted the bucket and poured green paint on my chest and legs and arms. It was cold and spread across my stomach like pancake batter.
Close your eyes, space boy.
I clenched my eyes shut and held my breath as he emptied the bucket over my head.
Shit, guys, come on, time's up.
I heard the empty thud when the bucket hit the floor.
Hold on. One more thing.
I was too afraid to move when one of them pulled something down over my head. I blew paint out of my nostrils, and when I breathed, it smelled like latex and cut grass. I lay sprawled on the shower floor, waiting for the next kick, but it didn't come.
Look at you. Look at what you've become without me.
Jesse's voice was muffled through the paint and whatever else covered my head, but it wasn't him. Jesse was dead. I'd seen his body. His parents had insisted on an open casket funeral, and I'd looked. Despite my brother's warning not to, I'd looked. He was so dead, and that last image of Jesse was the one that remained with me. Dead was the way I saw him from that point forward.
You're a punchline, Henry. The butt of a cruel joke.
It wasn't Jesse.
I'm beginning to think you should have hanged yourself rather than me. I probably would have cried over you, but I wouldn't have come to this. Jesus Christ, you're fucking pathetic. I don't know what I ever saw in you.
It wasn't Jesse. I repeated that over and over. Jesse was dead. Jesse had loved me. Jesse never would have said those things.
I only killed myself because of you. To escape you. You smothered me, Henry Denton. You loved me to death. You should be dead, not me.
It wasn't Jesse. Couldn't have been Jesse. But he was right. I should be dead. I wish I were dead. Because you can only die once, but you can suffer forever. Coach Raskin discovered me at the end of last period, when he came to shut off the lights. Finding me victimized and covered in green paint on the shower floor probably confirmed his opinion of my weakness. I'm willing to bet there was some small part of him that thought I deserved it. He cut the tape around my wrists and ankles, moved me into his office, and gave me a towel, but he refused to let me go home. Principal DeShields arrived shortly after and hammered me with questions. Who had attacked me? Had I provoked them? What were their names? Why was I in the showers? I did my best to provide answers, but my head throbbed, and the fluorescent overhead lights buzzed bright and sickly. I wanted to go home, clean the paint off, and never return to CHS again. I didn't mention smelling Marcus's cologne, because it would have pitted his word against mine, and he had the benefit of both the car and money. The paramedic's arrival saved me from further interrogation, but aside from scraped knees and elbows and slightly swollen testicles, I was unhurt. They took my vitals anyway and tried to clean some of the paint from my face and around my eyes. The police arrived next.
Are you Henry Denton?
The officer stood in the doorway of Coach Raskin's office. Her name tag identified her as Sandoval. She was stiff-backed with serious eyes and a crooked nose. I should have been grateful to see her, but this made it real. She'd file an official report, and everyone would know I'd been assaulted. Now I had no chance that this would quietly disappear. Principal DeShields straightened her cream-colored jacket and shook Sandoval's hand. Her dour frown met Sandoval's humorless eyes, and it looked like a competition to see who could take my situation more seriously.
I'm Margaret DeShields, principal of Calypso High School.
Then she fell silent.
like she'd planned a whole speech but had forgotten it.